Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and each week we bring you exciting new guests to talk about, of course, various aspects of UFOs and the paranormal. And there's so much to talk about. I've been doing this show for almost 3 years now, and it's amazing how many people are out there who have just incredible amounts of information to share that is really mind-blowing stuff. I hope you enjoyed our show last week. We had a very interesting guest on who went by the name of Commander Sonny Sato. And Sonny claims to actually recall a past life as being a survivor of the Roswell UFO crash, which I know that sounds amazing, but she really did have a lot of very interesting information to share. She's written 2 books, and it was really a really very interesting story. So if you didn't get a chance to catch that show, remember all the shows are archived on the BBS website. So check it out after the show, and I think you'll find it very interesting. And tonight, we're going to move in a slightly different direction. We're not really going to be talking about UFOs tonight. Instead, I'm very excited to have a guest who has released 2 films, actually. One is called Ancient Code, the movie, and the other one is called The Roslyn Frequency, Uncovering the Hidden World of the Knights Templar. Now, for anyone who's living in the world today, they know how hectic things have become in modern times. I mean, we're dealing with a number of really, really potentially catastrophic issues. We have a huge financial crisis. We have a global warming problem, pollution, warfare. The world is constantly at war and does not seem to be stopping. These prescription drugs that have taken over our society and are being pumped into masses, and it just goes on and on. The energy crisis, the changing climate, the worshipping of celebrities, the decline of a religion. But you know, this is very interesting times, and this is in part what this movie, The Ancient Code, is about. And it features a lot of very outstanding researchers, including Philip Gardner, John J. Harper, Professor Hugh Montgomery, Nick Pope, a whole bunch of really quite well-known people, including Brian Allen, who is our guest tonight. And he's going to be talking about the Ancient Code, what it is, and how it has the power to transform not only the individual, but society at large, and how it's a deceptively simple thing and yet has been overlooked in modern times. And I want you all to give a nice big welcome to our guest, Brian Allen. Thank you, Brian, for coming on the show.
Hi, Preston. Yes, I'm delighted to be here, and hopefully I can get some good information across.
I think so. Well, you're all the way there from England, right? It's 3 a.m. there?
Well, that sounded like me calling you a Canadian. No, I'm all the way from Scotland.
Okay. Very, very interesting. Wow. Well, I want to thank you so much for staying up that late to share your information, which I find fascinating. I've seen the film. It's very well put together and just really quite amazing, actually. So I want to thank you very much.
Yes, I'm absolutely delighted to be here. So would you like me to make a start, yeah?
Oh, definitely, yeah. If you could just let us know a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in such an unusual project and what inspired you, and yeah, we'll go from there.
Okay, well, I guess if I went into that kind of detail, we wouldn't have much time for the subject matter, so I'll try and cut it as short as I possibly can. Well, I've been involved in paranormal research, UFO research, for I guess the past 50 years, one way or another. I mean, I'm old enough to remember George Adamski when he first came to the surface, you know, so that'll give you an idea how long I've been around. But I've researched, as I say, the phenomenon of UFOs and the paranormal. And I guess I came to the same conclusion that, unfortunately, the now late John Keel came to, is that they're all part of the same phenomenon. There is no difference, for example, between angels and aliens, except in the context and the area when they were actually seen or contacted. So once I sort of defined that in my mind, that the paranormal and UFOs are part of one and the same phenomenon, then it all starts to pan out a little. And in my time, I guess I've spoken to abductees, interviewed them. Have I seen a UFO? Yeah, I've seen a UFO. Have I seen ghosts? Yeah, I've seen ghosts. Have I encountered poltergeists? Yeah, I've done that too. I've been at some exorcisms that would really stand your hair on end. And in that time, I guess I've learned quite a lot. But because of this experience, I've managed to write the 6 books so far, and I've just shortly finished a co-written effort with Philip Gardner, who you already mentioned, who directed The Ancient Code. And this particular book that I've just finished with him is called From the Dark Wood to Hollywood. And what it is, it's a deconstruction of the Robin Hood myth. And once you start looking behind the surface of Robin Hood, you start finding some really, really strange stuff. There's a lot of Gnostic truths in there. You're going back to ancient ways of living, the ancient thoughts. Herne the Hunter, Puck, the Green Man. You start going back to Osiris. And going back to a whole sort of ancient myths that have been with us since time began itself. So you tend to find that Robin Hood is not so much a character, but it defined a type of character who was normally come under the general heading of being a hero. Just as Jesus Christ was a hero, just as Osiris or Mithras or many of the ancient sun gods, of which Jesus was one, they were all come under the general heading of heroes, and Robin Hood was exactly the same. But that's basically me and where I came from. But it was enough to attract attention from various people, and it was just through a chance encounter on the internet that I came across Philip Gardner, and we sort of hit it off pretty well straight away, and I've become involved with both his organisation, which is Nucleus Agency, and also with Reality Entertainment, who produced both the DVDs. And I'll maybe start talking a little bit about the DVDs now for me.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll perhaps start off with The Ancient Code, which is really what this is all about. Now, I should maybe tell your listeners that The Ancient Code and, incidentally, another DVD that I feature and called The Roslin Frequency will be available on the 28th of this month on general sale. And also a book called The Ancient Code, which is actually constructed of a series of chapters, separate chapters written by the people who contributed to the film, and as with the rest, and I've managed to create a chapter for the book myself. So it's on release next month sometime, but I can't give you any release dates about that. But perhaps we should look first at how the Ancient Code, or the concept of the Ancient Code, actually came about, and once again I'm going to start to sort of refer back to Philip Gardner, who is, I guess, one of the best known documentary filmmakers around just now, and he's also a well-regarded author of many books now, 7 or 8, maybe 9 books, I think Philip's knocked out now. But how this actually came about was while Philip was filming in Australia, and believe it or not, he came to face with a kangaroo. Right out there in the sort of Australian backlands. And it just suddenly, when he looked at this unusual animal, which, I mean, let's face it, it is a pretty weird looking beast, that Philip realised there was some sort of intuitive connection to nature here that was missing really big style from our own material world. And at that time, I think Philip must have experienced a genuine epiphany, a sort of spiritual awakening, if you will. There was a sudden step change in his awareness. And I think that happens to most of us at some time. It's happened to me several times when I've been writing and researching my books. and it changes your outlook on reality and perception, and when it happens, that change is permanent. Now, I'll give you a little example of this, is that when I've been researching books, you know, and I've been looking for information all over the place, I've been, you know, been going on Google, going on Wiki, going around whole different reference libraries and so forth, that, you know, I'll be puzzling over some missing link, something that would join two areas of research that I'm actually looking at together. Then all of a sudden, I'll get a phone call, I'll pick up a newspaper, I'll read a book, or I'll get an email from some person, I don't know them from Adam, and it'll contain this little missing link. Now, at first I used to wonder why this happened, and it used to scratch my head a little. But now when it happens, and I swear to God, Preston, that this happens all the time now, that I just look up and say thanks.
I know exactly what you're talking about. It kind of makes you feel like you're in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, it's these synchronicities that just happen all the time. I know that cognitive scientists and psychologists will tell you that synchronicity is just an act of your own imagination, but it's not. I am certain that pretty much, when I mentioned John Keel, that John had much the same sort of outlook as myself on this phenomenon, is that there is some sort of cosmic joker out there, and he is watching over us, and they drop these little bombshells into your life whenever you need it. And this is an absolute truth, and I just don't question it anymore. Like I said, I just say thanks. But it's a fascinating aspect of the research that I do. But I'll just talk a little bit about Phil Gardner now before we move on. That how I got to know Phil, as I mentioned, was through the internet, and in fact, the first time we actually met up was when we were making the Roslin Frequency Project, when we were working together, Matt. And I was talking at a UFO conference about something that I christened the Hole in the Sky, and Phil used the opportunity to come along and do the sort of two-camera stuff that he needed for the Roslin Frequency. And that was when I got to know Phil, and because during the filming process we had a chance to talk a great deal. We had a chance to sort of exchange a lot of information, and we found out that not only were we reading from the same book, we were actually at the same word in the same book, that Phil, his outlook and mine are almost identical. If he was talking or I was talking, the only difference would be in the accent you were hearing. Because we are very, very close and share very, very similar views on this sort of thing.
Interesting.
Yeah. But in the film itself, the people you have in it, now, this may not mean too much to your audience in America, so I'll fill in a little bit on the people that I mentioned. One guy is a guy called Johnny Ball, who is an ex-TV presenter, radio presenter, and in the UK here, he's fairly well known as a sort of a reasonable, easygoing, quite well read type of guy. Another guy, and a quite interesting guy, is Professor Hugh Montgomery, who is a medieval historian and a Knights Templar researcher, and is also the Grand Master of an organization called the Order of the Fleur de Lis, which is a precursor of the Priory of Sion, and I expect you've probably heard of that organization in relation to the Da Vinci Code and so forth. Another guy who is involved, his name is Tim Wallace Murphy. Now, he's an author, an esotericist, and a researcher, as I am, into Roslin Chapel. Now, along with a colleague of his called Marvin Hopkins, they wrote a series of books regarding Roslin Chapel and what it may be, what it's in there. And the chapel itself has so many different facets to it, that almost any template you can make for it will fit. Certainly mine seems to do so, but we can maybe talk about that a little later. But basically what they came to the conclusion was that the Roslin Chapel is a grail chapel, and there is much in it that represents evidence of being, if you like, a stone-built version of the Holy Grail. But like I say, I don't quite share that point of view, but Tim Wallace Murphy is a very erudite, very well-educated man, and he makes a very good case for it. He also researched the Rex Diaz families, along with Marilyn Hopkins. Now, the Rex Diaz families are the god kings. They were believed to be descended from the priests, the priests who originally served in the original Temple of Solomon. And their descendants are believed still to be around the world today, away in the background, you know, pulling the strings, if you like. But again, Tim is quite an interesting character. And there's another character called Steve Mitchell who appears in the film, who's a musician and mathematician, and also Nick Pope, who you may indeed have had on your show at some point. Have you had him on your show?
No, but I know who he is. He's a UFO researcher.
Well, that's absolutely right. He was an officer with the British Ministry of Defence, the report coordinator at the UFO desk. He was one of the guys that used to tell you that all the reports that were received were of no defence significance. You know, but they sort of scrummed a little bit when they were asked, you know, well, why do these things fly about our airspace and you're not doing anything about it? Well, the reason for that is, of course, they couldn't. But they can't possibly tell the public that to their face, because otherwise it'd be people be running about in all directions in a panic. But the other character who made the film and also does some voiceovers in it is Phil Garner himself.
Yeah, and that's what's one of the really great things about your film is all the different people you have on it, creating all these different perspectives.
Well, that's exactly my impression, that Phil did try his hardest, you know, to get as wide a range of points of view as possible. But they're all points of view that are harmonious and appear to be pointing in the same direction, which I guess is the main thing. But another aspect of the film, which is actually, it's not quite so high key, but it's actually extremely crucial to understanding what the film and what the ancient codes are all about. Now, if you've seen the film, you'll have obviously seen something called the Horn Dance being carried out in a village called Abbots Bromley in England.
Right.
Now, the Horn Dance, just like this will maybe help your audience to sort of see a little, get some insight into this. Now, the Horn Dance, it's a continuation of an ancient pagan fertility festival. And what actually goes on there is that these dancers all carry a series of ritual moves, and each dancer carries a set of stag's antlers. I think there's 7 or 8 of them, maybe 10. I can't really remember the precise number. It doesn't really matter all that much. But they all carry these horns that have been taken from stags, and some of them date back to the 11th century. So, I mean, some of these sets of horns are pretty old. But the dance itself dates from around the 11th century. And what this is all about, as I say, is fertility and remembrance. And this type of dance is actually found all over England in one form or another. And it's usually called something called a Morris dance. Now, it's been claimed that this term Morris dance, that doesn't refer to a man, it refers to Moorish, or the Moors, who swept over Europe, as you probably know, back in the 10th and 11th, 12th centuries, from the east, until they were sort of driven back in the various punitive wars that carried out at that time. But basically, it's all connected to pre-Christian pagan times and the worship of the sun god Bel or Baal. It also is a nod to Herm the Hunter, the green man, who is the traditional god-man, an essence of nature and fertility. Now in Scotland up here, we celebrate this festival annually in our capital city, Edinburgh. It's called Beltane. Now Bel, it is actually a version of Baal, a shortened version of Baal. And it's a very spectacular fire tribute that pays tribute to the fertility and to the planet itself. Now, basically what Beltane is, it's a fire festival. It's an attempt to call the sun back. But, you know, as I said, this is in winter this goes on, at the beginning of the year. Mm. Back end of the year, beginning of the year. And what it's about is encouraging the sun to come back after its long hibernation, you know. So basically what we're seeing is an invocation of the sun god in Beltane. And it's pretty spectacular. It's been, I guess, in the last 14, 15 years that the actual subject was revived as a public spectacle. And these guys go around what's called Carlton Hill in the city of Edinburgh, swinging these fire torches around their heads, you know, and it becomes quite a wild night out. It's a sort of a second New Year's Eve for Scotsmen, you know. I guess it gets quite wild. But yeah, what it's about basically, it's the Scottish version of the Morris dance, but it's only carried out on one particular time of year. Whereas in England, the Morris dancing goes on in various places in the late summer. And it basically all goes back to sun worship and fertility. So it just shows that the world we're living is actually found.
My sister actually does Morris dancing, or did, at the Renaissance Fair here in Southern California.
Oh, so really?
It made it all the way over to here on the other side of the world, so.
Yeah. In some ways, there's a sort of friendly rivalry between Scotland and England here, because the English guys are always making fun of the Scots and for wearing their kilts, you know, and doing dancing over swords. So we always strike back saying, "Well, what about you guys and your Morris dancing? What about you guys? You know, don't laugh at us, you know." So there's always a bit of friendly rivalry about this. But there are actually some elements of the paradigm of fertility and renewal. Now, I guess you'll remember the film The Wicker Man. I mean, I think the last one that was made featured Nick Cage.
Right. I like the original much better, actually.
It was a far better film, much more frightening, I thought. What these are, they're examples of remember them celebrating our debt to the planet. I mean, we owe the planet. It's not your birth. It's kept us safe. It's allowed us to take its bounty. So at some point we've got to pay this back. And basically what we see is nature and man are mixing. One is remembering the other and honouring the other. And the reasons are probably not understood by these. Now, this is a strange thing, that I suspect that many of the people who perform these dances, and they're not really dances in point of fact, they're rituals. I don't think they fully understand what they're doing, and it's just become a habit. You know, they do this because that's how it's been done, you know, for decades and centuries in some cases. But they don't understand the relevance of what they're doing, but I don't think it really matters, because as long as the rituals are being carried out, the people who organise these do understand what it's been doing. And as long as, I think, as the ritual is carried out, and the people who organise the rituals know what's going on, it doesn't really matter if the guys who carry it out do. I think the main purpose of it is just to ensure that the ritual takes place. Because I think that some of the old pagan beliefs in magic, if you like, are well-founded. And these dances, or these rituals, are part and parcel of all that. But unfortunately, the people who do really understand what it's all about are often quite reluctant to discuss it, and often get quite aggressive if questioned, and it's almost as if it's a desire to protect the origins and beliefs associated with it. They don't want any sort of dilution taking place, just as religion has been diluted over the centuries, over the millennia. It's become diluted into various schisms and split-offs and various dead-end sources.
Well, it's fascinating because this is such ancient knowledge, and people have tried to protect it, and certainly we know how, you know, throughout history, knowledge has been threatened and lost, and this is exactly what you're talking about, in fact. So people would be defensive and want to protect, you know, the meaning behind these rituals and ceremonies.
Oh, sure. I mean, the old ways involving actual human blood sacrifice, in a way they're being reenacted. And in some cases they use animals rather than human beings. But the dance actually might be instinctive. It's almost like a genetic trace memory of the ancient code. And as you watch some of these dances, they're almost hypnotic in the way they repeat and repeat and repeat. It's almost as if carrying them out at a certain speed, the motions that they go through are repetitive. It's almost as if your body is instinctively remembering what the displays are all about. Something that's tugging at your memory. It's whispering you to remember. Remember, look. Remember. It's trying to take you back and teach you a practical lesson in how you interact with the planet. Now, I'm not going to say that this is some sort of, you know, I'm not on a green crusade here by any manner of means, because I think it's much more than that. And as this discussion progresses, I think you'll find that the ancient code is considerably more than a green crusade and carbon footprints and stuff. This is something more fundamental to the survival of the human race on the planet, because the ancient code, as you're going to find out, or hope I can convince you, that I think what the ancient code is, the planet itself is sentient in a sense. And I'm not just talking about the Gaia hypothesis either. What I'm talking about is a genuine sentience in the planet, and you are the planet and the planet is you. And I'll try and demonstrate that a little bit later as well. But what I think the planet may be doing is trying to make it evolve again. Because the human race stopped evolving thousands of years ago, and it stopped evolving because it didn't have to evolve anymore. Because everything settled out, and the human beings that were there, their evolutionary pattern was stopped because they were quite happy with what they were seeing. The conditions, the atmosphere was right, the temperature was right, everything was right, so they didn't have to evolve. So perhaps because the planet is running down in a sense that all its natural resources are still being used up, that it wants us to start evolving again to learn how to survive in this new environment, but that's something we'll get to there. We'll get to that in a little bit. Now, what is the ancient code itself? Well, this is a big, big question, and it has many, many implications. Because I believe, as does Phil indeed, that the ancient code came with the Big Bang creation, call it whatever you want. Now, this is more than mere genetics. It's more than DNA, although the code is there too. But it's considerably more fundamental than this. So you could say, is the ancient code what we call God? Although it has nothing to do with any religion. In fact, the ancient code long predates it. And it is a much more all-encompassing and powerful thing. Now, did the ancient code bring about the Big Bang? Or did the Big Bang bring about the ancient code? Because the two are virtually inseparable. In fact, the code itself is a very, very odd concept. It's both a message and it's a truth. It's fleeting and ephemeral, yet it's incredibly strong, permanent, and absolutely unyielding. This will not move it. You know, it's going to be there till the end of time. It used to be demonstrated in animism and nature worship. The shamans understood it. They still do. We, unfortunately, with our arrogance, tended to forget all about the ancient code, and we moved on in our own direction, doing our own thing, and just disconnected from the planet. And organized monotheism did not, could not, and will not understand it. In fact, it's just jealous of the ancient code. It's what actually turned me off mainstream religion completely, because you become exposed to what a lie it all is. And those who couldn't observe its teachings tried to destroy it, but they didn't succeed. Because it's still there. Because what the ancient code is, in fact, is that you, me, the audience, everyone on this planet, are atoms, if you will. The smallest, smallest particle that makes us up stretches right back to the Big Bang. Now, the reason for this comes about through the hypothesis that the particles that make us up, the particles that make up the planet Earth, that make up the Sun, make up all the stars, all the planets out there, and everything in between, have all been touched by, at some point, the particles that came from the Big Bang. So that the argument here is that you, Preston, you actually go right back to the Big Bang, and the particles that make you up go back to the Big Bang, as do mine and everyone else out there.
I always tell people, and I agree with that. I always tell people I'm 5 billion years old, at least.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes I feel that way, too, you know. everyone goes back that far. So the people, the Hindus, the people with the Eastern religions, they instinctively understood this. That you've heard the old sort of New Age mantra of all is one, they're true. These are absolute truths, and it was the arrogance of the monotheistic faith, be it Christianity, be it Judaism or Islam, that actually became so arrogant in their own beliefs that they lost sight of this, and they are just to worship this one God, this monotheistic God. But the whole point is that we don't even know if this God that they worship is even sentient or even exists for that matter. What is more likely is that here in Earth, now I don't want to upset any of the people that are listening to you, but if they feel like phoning in and questioning me on this, I'm only too pleased that we don't want to be happy if they did. That in the years I've been around now, and I've been looking at research in various aspects of the paranormal, as I say, I mean, I've seen ghosts and all the rest of it, contact spoken to them for that matter. What we do is we worship the sun just as our ancestors worshipped the sun. Right. Jesus Christ was a sun god. Tammuz was a sun god. Horus was a sun god. Mithras, the cult of Sol Invictus. They're all elements of the sun god. Now, man, the Mesoamericans worship the sun. You know, down in South America, these guys in the pyramids, they sacrificed thousands of the people that captured in battle, or do it ceremonially to their own people, so that the blood from the victim ran down the pyramid and it made the ground fertile, and it was also an offering to the sun to rise each morning, because as far as they were concerned, when the sun went down, it had died. The place was in darkness, so it had to be revived again. So the greatest honour, the greatest enticement they could offer it was to spill blood on the ground. And that blood, of course, would nourish the ground and encourage the sun to come back. And sure enough, the sun rose every morning. So obviously, it must have been working, so they kept on doing it. So they did it for a long, long time. But the strange thing, again, is that traditionally, when Jesus Christ was crucified, he was crucified facing west. And traditionally, again, when churches are built, the end where the minister or the priest preaches faces east, okay? So if you can picture that as the Christian saviour is facing west, you are facing east. So that symbolically, you're seeing the dying and rising God. So I suppose you could say that the 24-hour cycle has been represented every Sunday or every day you go to church. And sit facing the east, because in Roslyn Chapel, if we get time to get that a little bit later on, we'll find that it is very much oriented to facing east, which I think maybe is all part of the mystery there. But anyway, getting back to where we were, the whole thing with the ancient code, as I said, we are connecting the code, the code is connected to us, and we are connected to the planet. And it's found in a concept called Atman, A-T-M-A-N, which is another term for cosmic consciousness. It's a Vedic term, comes from Hindu philosophy. It's a much more accurate and acceptable way. It's really close to the line to the ancient code than any of the relatively recent religions. Besides, all religions are based on it anyway. As hinted in the previous question, it's the intuitive connection to nature which brings about bliss. That's spoken of their ancestors. It's mentioned that it came right at the beginning, and it's a sourceless nirvana. It's a genuine gnosis. This is an absolute truth. As I already said, this is cosmic consciousness. Now, mentioning gnosis, I know that your knowledgeable audience will know, is seeing the duality in everything that's round about us. So that most things have two meanings. You tend to find that the ancient writers, the old writers, I'm talking about the pre-biblical times, they understood Gnosis. And even in more modern times, you've got the Cathars, you had the Bogomils, you had the Manichaean heresy, which were all based on Gnosis, which was that there were two gods. And there was a spiritual god, and there was a god of the earth who was the Rex Mundi. Now, the Rex Mundi was a creature they gathered, as far as they were concerned, the Rex Mundi was Satan, if you will. Now, this did not sit well with the Catholic Church at all, who, of course, had the Cathars hounded to death eventually and Their Last Stand, which was, of course, on Montségur at the Langue d'Oc in France, which was the last of them. But as far as the Catholic, as far as the Catholic Church was concerned, their whole entire ethos was built on buildings, huge buildings, on physical displays of wealth. Now, the Cathars rejected that entirely because, as far as they were concerned, their God was one of pure spirit. And you can see the logic in that, I suppose, is that as soon as you were equating God or pure spirit with something physical, then the two didn't compute. Therefore, the Cathars rejected that, and for that, they were literally hounded to death by the church at that time.
Wow.
But like I say, these certain faiths got it absolutely right. And we knew this instinctively. It wasn't hype. It wasn't a pretense. It was the truth. And it was perhaps the only truth. And it's why the two ancient beliefs are still there. And monotheism, which is the driver behind the laws of Abraham, Christ, and Muhammad, is slowly crumbling. And really, there's nothing left to sustain it but belief alone, but faith alone. And as Mark Twain said, faith is actually believing in something you know isn't true. So, I know it's a very contentious issue, and maybe it's not an issue you would prefer that I didn't talk about on your show. But you'll tend to find that once you start examining the sort of wider implications of the ancient code, that this all becomes part and parcel of it. And some people find it quite frightening, because it threatens the very core of belief systems that have held all their lives. And they're very, very reluctant to let go. Can I just tell you, Preston, in all honesty?
Yes.
That when I was introduced to the idea of the ancient code, I suppose it started tugging little tendrils of memory inside me. And you started making little connections, you know, little keys started fitting together, parts of the jigsaw went in. And once you embraced the ancient code, I mean, it's not like somebody knocking on your door asking for money or people trying to sell you things. It's not about that. But once you start embracing the ancient code, you suddenly realize your paradigm changes immediately. And you start seeing the world in a different way. You start seeing that there are things out there, pardon me, there are things out there that shouldn't be there. There are things out there that need changing if we're going to survive. And the ancient code, as far as I'm concerned, is the only way that we're actually going to survive, and this planet's going to survive, if we start looking back to the precepts of the ancient code itself. But you say, well, why should this be? That there's a guy called John Gribbin, who's a remarkably insightful physicist. In fact, he was the author of The Search for Schrodinger's Cat. And it was he also that suggested that our senses contain particles that everything has interacted right back to the Big Bang. In fact, we are a single system, and part of that single system. In fact, the universe, for all its diversity, and the Earth, for all its diversity, with all its plants, its animals, its everything that makes it up, is a single system.
Right.
And I think a lot of that single system that we all belong to, excuse me, I'm getting a little bit husky here. I was kind of coughing before I came on air. this single system may be how the paranormal works. It may be the function behind the paranormal. It may be how, for example, telepathy works. The ability to communicate with other people, you know, by instinct alone, is because what we're doing is we're tapping into the single system. Some people can do it instinctively. I think most of us can be taught how to do it. But at some level, we are all part of this one system, and we are in contact with ourselves and the planet and, I suppose, the universe and all it contains. But at some automatic level, we are nothing like one with the universe, and this is why so many of the phenomena that I've talked about actually work.
Right.
It also hints and implies that such talents as psychometry and clairvoyance function through this ancient connection established when the universe began, rather than some hypothetical psychic radio frequency accessible only to psychics. So you start to wonder, do these particles actually talk to one another at some level? Are they actually aware? In other words, is the tiniest atom, is the tiniest subatomic particle sentient, is it aware that we are looking at it? Now, I can sort of demonstrate this. Now, a few years ago, the US Department of Mines carried out an experiment. Now, you may have heard the experiment, a watch kettle never boils or a watch pot never boils. So what they did was to test this out. They took a bunch of beryllium atoms. Now, don't ask me how they did this, because I'm not a physicist. I don't understand how they do these things. But then again, I don't know much about electronics, but it doesn't stop me looking at a TV, you know. But they took these beryllium atoms, and they actually encased them in a bottle, in a pot, which was actually a magnetic bottle, if you like. They encased them in this bottle. And they heated them using microwaves. Now, the watching part of this experiment came by using a laser. And when they were watched, the laser was on. When they weren't watched, the laser was off. So they timed how long it took these things to heat up to a specific temperature. And they found out that when the laser was on, it took longer to heat up than when it was off. Now, if anything, the laser should have speeded up, obviously, because it's hot anyway, it's light. It's amplified light. But if anything, that laser should have speeded up the heating process, but it didn't. It slowed it down. So this makes you wonder. It certainly makes me wonder. Were these subatomic particles in some way sentient and aware they were being watched? I mean, or was it because the expectations of the scientists who knew what the problem said caused it to happen and were actually influencing these subatomic particles by just thinking about it? It's certainly, whatever happened, this is what they found.
Yeah, I've heard of that. The Heisenberg principle. I mean, what you observe, you change.
That's right. It's the Heisenberg principle, that's absolutely right. You can predict either the speed or the position of a subatomic particle, but you can't do both. That's right. really weird stuff. Yeah.
Well, it seems like at the quantum level, we can control, I mean, we have some effect, our mind, on the universe. So it makes you wonder, I mean, it's no surprise that at a larger level, macroscopic level, that we are communicating with ETs and ghosts and God and different aspects of this phenomena. This is, I guess, what you're saying, right?
That's exactly what I'm saying, Preston. So, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, is this the ancient code also aware in the extent that the subatomic particles are aware? And is it now waking from a slumber, a million-year slumber? And is this what is behind the wars and tribulations? Is this the much heralded end times? Because I think one of the things that's mentioned on the cover of the ancient code, the film, is that make yourself aware of the new 2012, you know, when there's going to be a great change. Now, this whole thing about the 2012 change, for want of a better word, that what really worries me about 2012 is there going to be a real media hype. It is going to get kicked up here. And as I talk, I think you're going to see where this is going. Because if you consider, was it just last year, earlier than this year? I think it was last year. It was when they were going to switch on the Large Hadron Collider over there in Switzerland, or the Swiss-French border. The newspapers and the media were getting into a real flap about this. And you know, they were printing all sorts of nonsense that it's going to create black holes, and these black holes are super dense, and they're going to fall out the magnetic bottle that contains the subatomic particles, and they're going to fall into the Earth, and the Earth is going to be destroyed, basically,
right,
when they switch on this Large Hadron Collider. Well, of course, being made in France, it broke down, you know, so which is not really surprising. So, I mean, the thing broke down, and it's going to be, I guess, next year, maybe before they get it working again. But basically, nothing happened, but one thing that did happen was that this kid gets so alarmed by the scary talk about what was going to happen to the Earth that she killed herself. Now, if that was just a machine getting switched on, can you imagine what's going to happen when 2012 comes around and the media gets into full swing? Because you're going to get every weirdo crawling out under every stone. There are going to be survivalist groups hiding themselves in the hills. You're going to get demonstrations in the streets. You're going to get religious crazies all out there, all stamping around and all begging for salvation. And all this says is there's going to be a change. It doesn't say there's going to be an end to the world. It doesn't say there's going to be an end to civilization. It just says there's going to be change. Now, if we tie that into the ancient code, is the ancient code part of this change? It's like I said, is it going to make us actually start evolving again? And that is what I think is going to happen. I think that, 2012 is going to usher in an evolutionary change for us. We're not going to disappear off the planet. We're just going to start changing in such a way that makes us more harmonious with it and capable of surviving on the planet. Because as we further denude the planet of its resources, the timber, never mind the coal, never mind the oil, because they'll always get around that somewhere. It's not that we're denuding the planet of, we're overpopulating it for a kick-off. It's not able to support us because we're actually breeding ourselves into a position where it can't support us. So it may be that breeding is going to slow down. We're going to have to stop reproducing, and the planet's really going to see that for us. Because if we can't do it for ourselves, maybe we need Mother to give us a smack and make us behave ourselves, and I think that's what's going to happen. But what I do think is that it's not going to be pleasant. I think there's going to be more trouble. I think there's going to be more upheaval. Basically, it may be that these wars that are happening with ever-increasing ferocity are perhaps nature's way. I know this sounds pretty cruel, but this may be nature's way of making us pay attention and making us reduce our own population. It's one possibility. It's not a pleasant possibility, but it's something that's got to be faced. And I think that it's fortunate that reality films actually decided to follow up Phil Gardner's original concept and bring it to the attention of the public. And when I contributed to the documentary, I didn't really realise the gut level impact that it would have. And what I can say to this is that having seen it and having participated in it, I can assure your audience that it's truly enlightening. But ultimately, it's a message of hope. This could take us right back to the Garden of Eden, in a sense, and it's not just hype. We have to do this. This isn't just blowing smoke rings and hoping for the best. We've got to take affirmative action to save ourselves. And this isn't like Al Gore trumpeting around the world with an unfortunate truth and all the rest of it. I mean, what Al Gore says is all well and good. I've seen the film and enjoy it. But I think it's rather more fundamental than that, that the change has got to be in us. And our requirements of the planet have got to change. And our needs, what we expect from the planet, have got to change. And the first thing we've got to do is stop breeding, basically, and get ourselves into a situation where the planet can actually afford to keep us. Because the way we're going, and the faster we go, it's just getting useless, it's getting hopeless, it's getting crazy. And the more this happens, the more polarization is going to occur. The rich are going to get more paranoid, and the poor are going to get nothing. So basically what you're going to have is not a war between countries for land. What you're going to have is a war between the classes for food, just for the very stuff to live. Now this may not happen in the next 20 years or so, but within the next century I think it will. I think we're going to be faced with a very real conflict between, if you like, the wealthy on the haves and the have-nots. Because basically, they've got to reach an accommodation somewhere in the middle. Now, I'm not talking about communism. God knows I'm not talking about that. But what I'm talking about is a form of fairness, a form of equanimity, if you will, where everybody has to their needs, and not people have you know, everything they could possibly need more, and other people have nothing, because that just is not fair. And fairness is what this is all about also. Now, how can we help people today? How can we bring this about? Well, as you mentioned in your preamble to the program, that what people need to do is cast off their gods, whether it's the church, the state, or Hollywood inspired sort of transient fashions. And what they need to do is find themselves. And the cult of celebrities is a prime example of this. You know, let's face it, I mean, Paris Hilton. Paris Hilton puts on a quarter of an ounce in weight. Oh, I don't know, the world's going to stop. You know, but really, who cares? Who cares about Paris Hilton? Who cares what she does? Really? Or who cares about Victoria and David Beckham? Who cares about these people?
Well, look at the effect Michael Jackson had on people. They worship him like he's some sort of deity. So, I mean,
well,
he's a musician and talented, but, you know, I see exactly what you're saying.
Well, this is exactly something. Basically, Michael Jackson, and I guess I better watch what I'm saying to you, otherwise I can get both put off the air. But, but Michael Jackson, okay, the guy had talent, I'll give him that, but he was not a god. He was a very fallible human being, just like you and I are.
BBSRadio.com. Hello, everyone. I apologize. It appears we have lost our guest. He was all the way in Scotland. But as the show is pretty much run out of time, I'm going to close it up for tonight. But you've been listening to UFOs and the Paranormal. I'm your host, Preston Denon. Our guest tonight has been Brian Allen. He's put out two very interesting films, one titled The Ancient Code, the movie, and another, The Rosalind Frequency, Uncovering the Hidden World of the Knights Templar. We only really got into Ancient Code, the movie, so I'm going to have Brian back onto the show because he didn't get to talk about the whole UFO section of his film, Ancient Code. Very interesting stuff. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I did. He's got a very interesting accent. I love a Scottish accent. But yeah, I'm going to have him back on the show, and I apologize for having to cut it short like this, but we will have him back. So that's our show for tonight. I want to thank you all for listening, and I hope you can join us next week when we bring on another exciting guest on UFOs and the Paranormal. Until then, have a wonderful night and a great week. Bye now.